I'm Ann Curran again. I'm not doing dirty poems this year, sorry. I'm cleaning up my act. But first, I wanted to start with an ad. This is my book, Me First, 106 pages, $15. How much do you think that is a word? I don't know either. At any rate, whatever it is, it's not enough. Okay. Anyway, I'll be glad to sign these for anybody that wants to hear them. Now, a large part of this book is based on interviews I did for Pittsburgh newspapers and magazines. So I'm going to do a few interview poems tonight. First one is me and Jack Klugman. Do you remember Jack Klugman? Okay. I guess people mostly remember him from The Odd Couple with Tony Randall. And I heard somebody's remaking that just today on NPR, I heard that. Okay, Klugman, I interviewed him when I was editor of the Carnegie Mellon magazine because he was an alumnus. And this poem has an epigraph by George Anderson, drama critic of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And that epigraph reads, "Interviewing is not a spectator sport." It was the worst interview ever, except the time when the Bulgarian ambassador ran his hand up and down my back while I stood asking him questions. A university money grabber comes with actor Jack Klugman and inhibits the one-on-one connection that allows real responses instead of packaged PR. She interrupts his answers as they start to bloom into genuine beliefs. She tries to reply to questions for him. She inserts her own shallow comments as though she is the point of the meeting. Mostly Klugman cries about the great cost of buying, feeding, training racehorses, intent on underlining his poverty. He feels her hands in his pockets and soul. He can't leave the restaurant soon enough. The next one is about another Carnegie Mellon alumnus, Holly Hunter. We all know Holly Hunter, right? Me and Holly Hunter. It's practically impossible to get an interview with Holly Hunter. I made dozens of calls, even one to her mother. "I know what you mean," Marguerite Hunter says. "I have a hard time reaching her myself." Her vigilant gatekeepers give me a date a couple of days before Christmas on the set of Copycat on San Francisco's man-made Treasure Island. She's much smaller than on this big screen, much smaller than the 5'2" she claims. No, she admits the fiery red hair isn't hers. She shows me her dishwater blonde roots. She's the last of 7 farm-grown kids. Georgia spills from her mouth. She chews up a phrase and spits it out the side. Ask a question she doesn't want to answer. She grins and offers a coy, "Huh?" She won't even discuss what work thrills her. Doesn't want to be a star or personality whose private life is public fodder. They cease to be actors, she believes. She's won all the prizes, including the Oscar for the piano, where she played a mute pianist. After our not very revealing interview, she insists like an eager fan that I see Sigourney Weaver at work on the set. When I trip into the truck the company has provided her, she tells me the hard part is over. It is for her too. She resisted my digging to discover the person hidden behind the characters she plays. And the third interview I'm going to go into was with Seamus Heaney, now the late Seamus Heaney. The competition's tough here. Heaney was coming into town to speak, to read at the International Poetry Forum. And I mentioned the Royal Ulster Constabulary, which is basically the Northern Ireland police, and the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, the group that wanted to take the six counties of Northern Ireland and incorporate them in the Republic of Ireland. I also mentioned the word prods, P-R-O-D-S, which is an Irish name for Protestants. Me and Seamus Heaney talk across the Atlantic Ocean before his Nobel. Me, perched on my bed beside the only phone that hooks up to my tape recorder. He, beside the waters of Dublin Bay, already bootless and knee-deep in poet talk. A cagey guy, he learned how to hedge, growing up Catholic in Orange Territory. Even wrote about a boyhood buddy killed by the Royal Ulster Constabulary without mentioning who did the deed. His excuse were they were off duty. Two bad apples, a nicely altered cliche. He's thinking. He knew readers would blame the IRA. He teeters atop the stone wall, appeasing prods. He lives at Harvard or in Ireland, where taxi drivers chat him up about his poetry. People approach him in the local pub, not like the ivory tower U.S. poets. Frankly, he charms me for 45 minutes with stories and beliefs wrapped in a green brogue. As we close, I say my contact wants him to do more press. His instant anger sizzles across the sea. You tell him I think I've done enough for him. That clearly included my grilling. Ouch. The distance between us suddenly expands, wider than the waters of the Atlantic. Now, I wanted to read something not from the book. I just got back from the Netherlands, where everybody speaks Dutch. That's not true. Everybody speaks English, except at the mass I went to. And this is called Going to Mass in Dutch. I swear, the first reading was all about applesauce, and apples aren't in season. Still, applesauce boils down the aisle. The priest adds, Chicago. Okay, I can get into Chicago. No other clues among the ch's. The sermon hisses. This guy is pissed plus. Fists swing up and down. Voice splurts hot venom. No music softens his god-awful tale. Congregants spout memorized responses. There are no altar servers, no surprise, but a swift blessing of the small children. The handshake of peace becomes a mere nod. For communion, the crowd kneels down at the rail, chopped down years ago by Vatican II. I hold my hands to receive the host. He parks at my lips, insisting on tongue. Did he never hear of the church changes? I leave, thermostat on a steady rise. My taxi driver doesn't understand. He belongs to the half who don't believe in God and trust only in bikes and dykes. And I'd like to close with me and my purse. This takes place in Connemara in Galway in Ireland. Me and my purse. My blood-red purse glows in morning sunlight. Once a real live cow, it turned grass to milk in Connemara, close to the ocean. My grandma milked it. I'm doing the same. I love applause. Our next speaker is Aaron Gartzka.
It's wonderful to be here among so many friendly faces. It's been a while, I'm a little rusty, but the first one will sound familiar. It's the last thing I brought to Squirrel Hill Workshop. I believe in stigmata, stars when they are absent, Dean's assertion that Godzilla came to Newport, the slow hiss of air from a balloon tied not too tight, the Santa Anas, snowstorms in Flagstaff, my father's voice, gold shoes, Highway 1, Big Sur rocking our car midnights in November, the tears of Eve, the silence of bones, rain washing down our window, leaves, mountain ravines in dreams, mermaids, pinwheels, stargazer lilies and birds of paradise, Winnie's 450-mile drive for a slice of pie, embers burning when blue and orange flames have gone, kites and clouds, clouds that are more than clouds, prayers without answers, lost sunglasses, warm socks, Fern Hill, the way the city jutted up hazy this morning from dank riverbanks, internal music, the dark and invisible, wind, nerve impulses, abysses, the ocean floor, morning coffee, wishing wells, ivy, a long, slow drink of water. And I don't write too many narrative poems, but I'm going to read one tonight. This one is dedicated to my dear friend, Bobby Bates. She liked this poem. Scar. At the supermarket, the checker's hands are quick as birds. As I load groceries on the conveyor belt, a jug of milk, dozen eggs, the great green lettuce rose landing with a thump as I glance up, my gaze stopping at the sight of two blue eyes. I look away, my embarrassment bright as the netted sack of oranges I yank from a rack under my cart. It is as though someone laid a hot poker across her left cheek, and I think of my glamorous grandmother, hospitalized when a garage door spring broke her nose, left its diagonal mark on her face. She is beautiful, dark hair past her waist, and young. As I was that day, I flew over bicycle handlebars and blacked out, my only proof, a blue scar snaking my left eye. Raised, her scar seems a worm inching alive. I reach for a brick of cheese and the beeping scanner stops. Quietly, she tells me of seepage from a basket of strawberries, and I can barely hear her over the prattling bagger, his tongue like the tail of a dog happy to see everyone. I start toward the produce aisle, but he offers to help. And I trust him, though I sense his pick will be worse than mine. In the heavy silence that hangs between us, I recall a kind lady in a Newport Pier beauty shop who sacrificed profit and refused to sell me makeup, told me I was lovely in my youth to enjoy it. Gave me that summer afternoon of uneasy peace. Her face glows with foundation, the scar an unnatural pink, and I want to murmur something tender and wise and holy without pity to this girl who could have been my daughter had God so desired. But my mouth is empty, empty as the womb ripped from me years ago, empty as a promise that can't be kept. I thank her and the beggar, hastily push away the cart, its telltale wheel thwapping. Hope there is time enough in this life to heal us. A number of years ago, I had the pleasure of going to the James Wright Festival with Christine, Dory, and Michael. It was a very fabulous day, and I was like a little girl at Kennywood crying when it was over. But I wrote this poem there on that day. Falling into the blue, a yo-yo of sun draws itself upward. For 3 years, 9 months, and 21 days, I've been living someone else's life. Robins sing against the backdrop of car wash roller brushes and a transistor radio. Patsy Cline's falling to pieces again, and her phrasing is impeccable. The last long note, blue ice and flame, as it escapes Martin's Ferry to float over the Ohio. Maybe this day is mine after all. My left eye feels familiar in its socket. The wristwatch with its missing piece of strap still adheres to my wrist. An unmistakable shadow has followed me here. Sprouting green, scarred earth above the town heals itself. Those scattered teeth of tombstones litter a distant hill's crest. Church bells ring as five-century pines hold up a canopy of sky. A chickadee lands on a sign, fixes his bright black eye on mine. Lapis lazuli and lemon coexist. All's well that ends well, I have heard it said, but must it begin so badly? The dandelion-bordered park with rounded corners hems me in until I want to springboard off of Fifth Street into the green, green grass. A brown-eyed girl behind Van Morris's stadium with lime sherbet on her tongue. Spring morning, great day to rob a bank. Wash windows, move out of state. I don't want to be the older sister, the aunt. Already my children are radiant as daffodils, numerous as stars, their music scrawled on the scrap of a flower sack. A rattletrap oven yawns and belches out last night's dreams of CPR as I rescue that rubber doll again. The one I couldn't save one April morning as her mother rocked and cried in the next room. What is it we are born into? Our nakedness is blinding. Holes shot through a storm door only let in more light. Im Herbst es regnet, in spring returning sun. The morning lamplights are pairing on the poles like lovers reunited after war. A child pens his name on the sidewalk with a yellow crayon, then jerks back the loop of string still attached to his finger. And I just want to close with a real simple little poem. It's kind of a group participation thing, so I'll need your help. And it's just called This Quarter Moon. When I raise my hand, I want everybody to say This Quarter Moon. Okay, so we'll practice now. Ready? Okay. This quarter moon.
This quarter moon.
Is Mona Lisa's smile on tiptoe? Is a handle whose cup is missing?
This quarter moon.
Is a hook to catch a flounder that grants wishes?
This quarter
is the silver boat of a lullaby I will never sing to my daughter. Is a parenthesis that lets lost love escape. Is the horn of an ox sent to bear our grief away. Is the tired eye of the world not quite closed. Thank you all. And our next reader is Nancy Esther James, who writes the most wonderful spiritual Eastern type poetry.